It's just a welcoming introduction from me here. Good evening, and welcome everybody to our lecture today. And a special welcome to our speaker, Setulengo Mathelesi. It's a great to have you tonight. This session is both part of the summer program of the Center for Cultural Inquiry and part of our lecture series, Forms and Spaces of Contemporary African Protest, that I'm co-convening together with Jeanine Madeleine Fisher, who will take over to moderate the discussion following Setulengo's lecture. My name is Billy Kalima, and I've been a fellow at the Cluster of Excellence from October 2020 to the 14th of April this year. At the Cluster of Excellence, the Politics of Inequality, and I did a project research on student activism in South Africa. And my co-convener, Jeanine Madeleine Fisher, is a member of the Interdisciplinary Research Group on Traveling Forms that is located here at the Center for Cultural Inquiry and is doing research on aesthetic activism in South Africa. Now it is my pleasure to introduce our speaker, Setulengo Mathelesi, to you. Professor Setulengo Mathelesi is an associate professor and academic head of Department of Sociology at the University of the Free State. His research interests lie in social movements, ranging from community protests at the municipal level to community mobilization against mining in South Africa. This scholarly work is underpinned by the theory of trust and participatory governance models. His recent publications include Civil Strife Against Local Governance, Dynamics of Community Protests in South Africa, which was published by Barbara Budrich in 2017, and Social Licensing and Mining South Africa, published by Routledge in 2020. He also acts as an anchor analyst for the South African Broadcasting Corporation, SABC, during elections. In addition, Setulengo regularly writes opinion pieces and provides commentary on social and current affairs on various media platforms. Today, Setulengo will give a lecture on community protests over perceived inadequate municipal delivery in South Africa from 2004 to 2021. Setulengo, once again, thank you for being with us, and the floor is yours.
No, thank you, Billy, for that introduction. And Matthew, welcome. I didn't know that my fellow South Africans will join me, so at least that gives me a bit of comfort that we've got some warm bodies from this part of the world. It's an absolute privilege. I cannot overemphasize that. When I got the invitation, you know, when you get an invitation, you're always a little bit apprehensive about whether you will be able to make it, but it's an absolute privilege to be able to join you here today. I just want to share my slides. I hope I will be able to do that. So as Billy have indicated, I am going to present on a community protest. In the media, community protests are popularly referred to as service delivery protest, and these protests are protests directed towards municipalities over the perceived inadequate delivery of basic municipal services such as water. But we all know, those who study within this field, that in most instances it has nothing to do with service delivery. There are other factors that comes to play, but at the end of the day, because your municipalities are closest in terms of governance to any other fear, and that is why perhaps municipalities will bear the brand of community protest. I would like to share As a point of departure, this quotation from Matt Joel, who is a mining engineer, and I quote, "Firstly, I need to declare that I'm not an academic, nor have I studied any of the social sciences or human behavioral fields such as psychology, nor have I gone down the MBA route. I am a dyed-in-the-wool mining engineer with a master's degree in engineering science. However, what I do have and what I want to share is over 30 years' experience working with, managing, and leading people, which is often a far more variable and volatile commodity than the mineral that I was trying to mine." So, close quote. What this actually is the crux of my presentation, which is sometimes it is extremely difficult to understand the intentions of individuals, even if we do study them. And I think that is very important to understand yet. But I want to provide you some background about where I come from with this kind of studies, but very briefly, and I'm not going to keep you long. I'm just going to try to go give you an overview of my field of expertise. My master's was on industrial sociology, my PhD on medical sociology, where I looked at the socio cultural context of tuberculosis. But I lost interest after my doctorate, and then I started focusing on social movements in South Africa. So I got funding for a three-year project, which led to a publication in 2017, as Billy have indicated, Civil Strifes Against Local Governance. And this particular project contrasted, and you will also see later, because in my presentation, what I'm trying to do, I've been involved in more than 40 case studies across South Africa. But what I'm trying to do in today's presentation is just to give you reflect on two case studies out of the 40 that I've been involved, because that will give you an indication of the situation in South Africa. So what I did in this three-year study, I focused on protest in your predominantly black communities and also protest emanating from your predominantly white communities, because there's a notion in South Africa that white people do not protest. They do protest, but they use a completely different view. And once again, I know that contexts are different. I'm a sociologist, and perhaps from a German side, you will understand why one would have to use a racial context here, because you still have situations where you still have predominantly black areas and predominantly white areas in South Africa. Now, secondly, out of this particular study, I realized, and it's not something that I focused on, was that, as I've indicated before we started with this talk, that in your mining towns, it is the underlying conflict between mining companies and communities that leads to protests. And that led to a second book by Routledge, which is Social Licensing and Mining in South Africa, another three-year project funded by the National Research Foundation in South Africa, because based on the first study, so it led to this publication. But from both studies, there's an outstanding issue that also, emerged from the first study and even the second study. And this is a notion, and I'm working on this. I haven't even started writing a book proposal for this, but I've published on this. It's the second book chapter that I'm working on, and I did publish an article. The article is called "A Hungry Stomach Knows No Allegiance, Transactional Activism in the Free State." State. That was published in 2018. And I'm looking at the role of, because what I've picked up is that by now we know what are the causes of these community protests in South Africa. We know who are involved, but what we don't know is the role of the social movement leadership when they engage. It's the whole notion of co-optation, you know, where they get rewards to try and stop the protest. But what is happening in South Africa is that you've got a situation where this leads to a vicious cycle of recurrent protests, because you are not dealing with the fundamental issue when you target challenges and offering them tenders and certain positions. So I'm still working on this, but all this emanates from this previous two studies. And as I've indicated, my work is actually informed by the analytical or the analytical constructions informing my work is based on categories of trust, whether it's rational choice, systems theory, social action, structuration, or moral trust. Those are the key theoretical insights that informs my study throughout the three studies that I've projects, research project that I've conducted over the past couple of years. And then also what is very important, I just want to give you an indication of where the cases are. This is a map of South Africa, and you can clearly see some of the case studies in South Africa, at least in 4 provinces of South Africa, 4 of the 9 provinces of South Africa. That's where my cases, like what I did in each province, I took a predominantly black community and a predominantly white community, like a ratepayer association or a civic organization. And this is what they called in your predominantly black communities in South Africa. And then also as a form of background, just to also indicate you, those of you who have read the history of South Africa, you will understand that protests did not arrive in South Africa after 1994, during the democratic dispensation in South Africa. In fact, South Africa, if you look at the history of South Africa, has a history of violent protest. But the first protest against a democratically elected government emerged in 2004 in 2 provinces, in the Free State and another one in Gauteng. That was only 2004, and it's almost 10 years after the first democratic dispensation. There might have been industrial, and one thing that I also need to clarify from the outset, this has nothing to do with your industrial action. These are community protests directed against local municipalities or your local government, and I think that one we need to just get out there. What we also know based from studies that have been conducted thus far is that these protests have diverse outcomes, but they are actually caused by a similar set, fundamentally similar set of grievances. And these grievances are complex, and one can actually categorize them as follows. It is all about your systemic issues like maladministration, issues such as fraud, nepotism, and corruption. And sometimes I must also emphasize, it might also just be perceptions, because in some of the case studies that I've been involved, it was very difficult to prove and verify the validity of that. But my take is that we've got a very vibrant participatory governance system in South Africa, where at local government you've got a word system, you know, local residents can participate, but we all know those structures are highly politicized. And the question is, how can your local participatory governance structures not pick up these misconceptions, and that is also a serious problem for community protests in South Africa. But there are also structural factors that contribute to this protest. We all know the issues of poverty, unemployment, land issues, healthcare, and I've just before we started, I've also briefed you about the respect that I have for our current president, but it seems as if politicians are politicians and their priorities are somewhere else, and unfortunately we are on a brink, and especially also what is happening in Ukraine, between Ukraine and Russia, where the prices in South Africa have skyrocketed, and there's just a possibility, it's not going to happen very soon, but it might also just contribute to unrest in the country if we are going to go on the same trajectory where people are not able to do it. And then lastly, also there's governance issues, limited opportunities for participation, lack of accountability, and the complete erosion of public confidence in your local government structures. I mean, I'm staying in Bloemfontein. Bloemfontein, it's one of the metro, it's your metropole, it's one of your, in terms of hierarchy, it's your highest, most sophisticated municipality, but it's a huge problem. The municipality can't even collect refuse on a weekly basis, but yet it's a metropolitan. So it's all these kind of issues that erodes public confidence in our municipal setup in South Africa. And then I just want to give you an overview of the major community protest since 2012. In terms of the numbers, one should also be very cautious. If you look at the sources, the municipal IQ, and there's a difference in how some, like for instance, the police will report on this protest. What the municipal IQ will do, it's if a protest erupts today and it lasts 3 days, they will take that as one episode, and they will not say every, you know, count it as three protests if it goes over 3 days. But in 2004, when the first community protest erupted, we had 10 protests. And if you look throughout all these years, you will see during each election year, whether it is a national election or local government election, then we see a spike in the number of these community protests. And perhaps the question will be why. One logical question is then the communities or the residents thinks that they've got much more bargaining power, because that's the time when political parties are actually going campaigning and seeking their buy-in. We can see 2018, 2014, 191, and you saw it goes even, you can look at 2014 up until 2008, 27, and then suddenly we had a provincial and national elections in 2009, almost triple the numbers there, 107, and so it goes up. We still don't have the numbers. And 2020, and I think this had to do with COVID, because, I mean, obviously the movement of people were restricted and all that. So this is only a count up until June last year, so we don't have the figures for this. So this gives you an indication of the number of community protests in South Africa since 2004. But then I phrased this presentation because I also had to ask myself questions around how to approach today's session. And I'm asking two fundamental questions. The first question that I'm asking is, how are service delivery, protest, socially constructed and rendered meaningful at collective level? And I'm going to try and answer both questions. And the second one is, what elements of the social fabric or enable communities to sustain community sustain mobilization against their local municipalities? And these are the two critical questions that I would like to answer. And as I've indicated, I'm using two case studies. There are many others which will be slightly different, but I just believe that the two cases that I will present will actually give you an overview of a situation in South Africa. And I'm using a predominantly, or else obviously, a ratepayer association, the Sannieshof Ratepayer Association, from the predominantly white town in Northwest South Africa, and your predominantly black communities, Kuruman. Now, there are 22 villages around Kuruman, much more rural villages around the town Kuruman, and this is my two cases. If you look at the first case of Sannieshof, what the ratepayer is doing, they use the tactic of withholding rates and taxes. Now, these are the municipal rates and taxes that needs to be paid over to municipalities on a monthly basis by residents. What they will do, they will open a trust account, and these members will pay it into the trust account of the ratepayer associations. But the protest in this particular, if you look at the history of this, and by the way, I must actually emphasize that in South Africa, the Sannieshof case, it's actually the ratepayer a case in South Africa, because it set the tone for many other interventions from these ratepayer associations, where they took on their respective municipalities. Now, this protest started in 2005 when Sibu is the Sannieshof Ratepayer Association, and I think this is an Afrikaans name for this particular ratepayer association. And funny enough, you can see there's a picture of a tractor. So what is apparently happening in this town is that you still have a situation, and it's very rare to have this in South Africa, where a tractor have to come and extract sewage from the household, and they do it once a week, or once your septic tank is filled up, you will call the municipality to try and do that. It's very rare to find this in your predominantly white areas in South Africa, anyway in South Africa. So, but this is still the situation in Sannieshof. So the municipal tractor broke down, and then there was sewage spillage for more than 7 weeks. And I mean, obviously, drinking water and boreholes became contaminated. And I had evidence that the residents tried to engage the municipality to see how they can solve that, but that was never resolved. And then in 2007, almost 2 years later, after numerous failed attempts to engage the local government, the local ratepayer association declared a legal dispute. What this means is that they approached the courts, and then they said they're going to deliver services on behalf of the municipality, because the municipality has been receiving funds, yet they failed. So what they did, they opened a trust account, and they are now employing their own workers to clean the town. Sometimes when an electricity transformer breaks down, the ratepayer association will pay for that, because in terms of management and response from the municipality, it has become a huge problem. Since then, as I've indicated, many other ratepayer associations has come to the fore. And what is also very important, they've got a national ratepayer association. And if you look at the structure of the ratepayer association, it's highly formalized, where meetings are held, and former bookkeepers, sometimes even former councillors who are serving as trustees of these ratepayer association. So in short, what they do, they withhold rates and taxes, but use that money to deliver services. Like, for instance, if something breaks down, they will clean and pay workers to clean the town. And you can go through Sannieshof, one of the cleanest towns in South Africa. So that gives you an overview of the ratepayer associations in South Africa. But from the side of the government, they regard these ratepayer associations as illegal and perhaps as white people trying to undermine a democratically elected government. But there is credible evidence to say that even before these ratepayer associations take their legal route, they've tried to engage not only the municipality, but other structures, other levels of governance without any intervention. Now, I'm moving to, perhaps I'm a bit too fast, to case number two, which is your predominantly Black communities. Now, this protest, it's where, very unfortunately, and these are parents using schools or their kids as bargaining power. This is how I phrase this. And this protest was over the building of a tar road. And I went to this, and as I've told you, there are 22 villages around Kuruman, and there's a stretch of almost 136 gravel road. I traveled on that road, and you can literally not travel more than 20 kilometers per hour. And with the people, the complaint there is you buy a vehicle today, after 3 months, it's a wreck. It's really terrible. Now, what happens, because Kuruman is a mining town, there are many mines around Kuruman. The mines did donate money, availed money for the project, for the road to be tarred, but the municipality never used the money. And then suddenly, the residents started, they call it the No Road, No School, protest. And then they shut down schools for close to 8 months. And this affected 50 schools and more than 16,000 learners for more than 8 months. If you look at that, even preschools were closed. And very sadly, a sad outcome of this protest was, for the very first time in the history of South Africa, parents deny their own children access to education in order to gain the attention of the government. I've got a colleague from the University of Johannesburg, Professor Carl von Hond. He wrote a book, The Smoke That Calls. And the whole argument of that contribution is that it seems as if our government is very reactive. They first want something to burn before they react. And when I asked these people, I thought initially when this protest took place and when I set up interviews, I thought I'm going to meet some young radical, respondents. But I was surprised. It was fairly elderly people. And they told me, I am from Bloemfontein, a city. They've got no facilities to burn down. So that's why they are using their kids as bargaining power. And this never even happened, not even during a time of apartheid, where parents were forcefully keeping their kids away from school to try and gain the attention of the government of the day. And there was sporadic, cases of where people were forced to stay at home for up to 2 weeks sometimes. The destruction of, public facilities, that was an ongoing thing during that time. But also just want to show you in terms of, this is a preschool. The preschools were also closed for almost a year. And what was happening in this small town because of the high level of intimidation, I had to do interviews while pretending watching a soccer match, because this is what the kids were doing. And based on other studies that have been done, issues such as teenage pregnancy increased in this particular area, crime, drug abuse amounts used, and one can directly link that to the protests that have been taking place in this particular area there. Now, coming back to the question that I've posed, because about what allows these two groups to continue to sustain their protests. I think it's very important to look in terms of what I've structured there, the organization of these groupings, the different groupings that are organizing these protests in South Africa. And you also need to look at the structure of these groups. But very importantly, what protest tactics do they use? Now, if you look at your predominantly white communities, as I've indicated, it's ratepayer associations. In your predominantly black communities, these are spontaneous and highly fragmented and groups which have weak authority. But if you look at your ratepayer association, they are highly structured, coordinated, and they've got a clearly defined leadership associated to a national body like the National Ratepayer Association. So that in itself already gives you an indication in terms of support that the ratepayer associations are getting, unlike these sporadic, highly fragmented civic groups in your predominantly white black communities. And the protest tactic that has been used by your predominantly white communities or ratepayer associations, as I've already indicated, they withhold rates and taxes, and they deliver services on behalf of the municipality. Whereas in most instances in your predominantly black areas, it is violent protests, the burning down of facilities, and this is largely to do with obviously the structure, which for me it's a very determining factor when it comes to whether a protest will be peaceful or violent. But I just briefly, I know I'm going at a very fast pace, I just want to give you another glimpse from case study about something about this transactional activism where leaders are being exploited to try and stop that. Now, one interview that I've conducted in another case study in the Free State, and I quote, and this is a protest leader, where one protester was actually shot live on television. It have drawn widespread international attention because for the very first time, police actually brutally murdered one of the protesters there, Andries Tatani, may his soul rest in peace. And here's the response from one of the protest leader. A hungry stomach knows no allegiance. Does the community really expect us to reject the offers presented to us? Yes, I got a job at a municipality, and I'm grateful that my role as an activist was not in vain. And if you look at another one from the very same case study about Kuruman, because I had to ask the question, why are you using your kids? Why are you keeping your kids away from school? And this was a response from one protest leader. Gentlemen, you see, you are from the cities. We have no public facilities to destroy. We close schools to draw attention to our concerns, but please go and investigate what happened to the protest leaders of 2012 and 2014. We also want to be employed by the municipality. close quote. What is happening here, this is just an indication, because Kuruman, there are areas in South Africa on an annual basis, they are so protest prone that I already know that there will be a protest somewhere. So Kuruman is one of those areas where almost on an annual basis, you can expect protest. So there's a vicious cycle of protest. And in the past, some of these protest leaders were employed by the municipalities and others employed by other government structures. Now, sometimes this may be perceptions, but in the eyes of the communities, these protest leaders got these gains because of their position as leaders in the civic groups. And I also then followed up and go and ask some of these municipal managers, and this was one of the response, well, from a municipal manager, well, if there are opportunities at the municipality, we do not do background checks on whether applicants were involved in protest or not. Every South African has a right to apply and, if successful, be appointed. But we all know sometimes that it's very difficult to prove these kind of things, that in most instances, this is how state actors deal with challenges. And the problem is, once you use this tactic, you are not dealing with the fundamental grievances of residents. In actual fact, that's why in some areas there are recurrent community protest. And just in conclusion, the cases in South Africa up to this far contribute to understanding how the complicated interactions between protest leaders and state actors have shaped a new generation of radicalized grassroots activists, advancing their own interest at the expense of movement goal attainment. And very importantly also is that the scale of and the capacity for violence, devastation, and death has escalated to unimaginable levels. Whenever there's a protest, one can expect that there will be fatalities in South Africa. And this evolution has also generated a concern with the morality and ethics in this protest, where people are now using protest to advance their own individual rights. But also, the question that we need to ask is, what future are we building if we are preventing children who actually have to use education to liberate themselves, to free themselves from the clutches of poverty and unemployment in South Africa? Vielen Dank. Thank you. I hope I've pronounced that well. So thank you, colleagues.